Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. I'm reading for you today in digest format, CQ Magazine, for April 2010. CQ is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Andiam System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handyham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handyhams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Handyham is always spelled lowercase H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. So, again, handyham@courage.org. Our website, www.handyham.org. Let's begin our reading today with Ham Radio News. Young Ham nominations sought. Nominations are open for the 2010 New Sline Young Ham of the Year Award. Nominees must be 18 or younger and must have made significant contributions to amateur radio and or their communities through the use of amateur radio. CQ is a co-sponsor of this annual award, along with Vertex Standard, the manufacturer of Yaesu brand ham gear. The winner will be recognized at the Huntsville Ham Fest in August. Complete information and the nominating form may be downloaded from www.arnewsline.org. Deadline for receipt of nominations is May 30, 2010. Ham killed in power plant explosion. A ham from Missouri was among five workers killed in a Connecticut power plant explosion in February that received national media attention. Chris Walters, call N0HVK of Florescent, Missouri, was a safety manager for an electrical subcontractor at the Clean Energy Plant being built outside Middletown, Connecticut. The accident occurred as workers were purging a natural gas pipeline. Its cause was still under investigation at press time. Walters was 48 and the father of three. According to the ARRL letter and Newsline, he was working temporarily in Connecticut after being unable to find work near his home. Walters was active in the local ham radio community around Middletown, joining the Shore Points Amateur Radio Club and volunteering for various community events. Herbert Pete Hoover III, called W6CH, also a silent key. Herbert Hoover III, better known to hams as Pete, W6ZH, passed away in early February at age 82. Pete's grandfather was President Herbert Hoover, and his father was former ARRL and IARU President Herbert Hoover Jr., the first, called W6ZH. An active ham for many decades, Pete was an early supporter of AMSAT, was one of the founders and first directors of the ARRL Foundation, and was a longtime member of the ARRL Long Range Planning Committee. Pete's family asks that those hams wishing to make contributions in his memory consider one of the following charities: Dohoney Eye Institute, 1490 San Pablo Street, Los Angeles, California. Hoover Institute, 434 Galvez Mall, Stanford University, Stanford, California. The Herbert Hoover Presidential Library Association, 302 Parkside Drive, West Branch, Iowa. Or the House Ear Institute, 2100 West 3rd Street, Los Angeles, California. The ARRL to seek limited revision of 97.113. The ARRL Board of Directors has instructed the league's staff to file a petition with the FCC seeking to add a provision to Section 91.113 of the rules to specifically permit the ham to operate, quoting, on behalf of an employer, close quote, in emergency drills and training exercises, as well as during actual emergencies. A question of appropriate ham radio operation by employees of public service agencies and other organizations has been a hot-button topic for months, ever since FCC staff said the rules prohibited operation on behalf of an employer, even when an amateur was acting as a volunteer, on his or her own time. The AWL board's action came during its January meeting and was reported by CEO Dave Sumner, K1CZ, in his editorial in the March issue of QST Magazine. CQ Magazine's parent company, CQ Communications Incorporated, and a group of three amateurs, including Gordon West, WP6NOA, have each already filed petitions seeking similar changes. Here's another interesting note on the news front for you old-timers. End of the line for Loran C. Loran C, the low-frequency, long-range navigation system that has guided ships and airplanes for more than 60 years, has been shut down by the U.S. Coast Guard. According to the AMSAT News Service, the shutdown came on February 8. President Obama had called the system obsolete, now that virtually all ships and airplanes and many land vehicles carry Global Positioning System GPS devices. The shutdown is expected to save the federal government some $38 million a year. The only drawback to the move is that there is no longer a backup system in the event of a massive GPS failure. New tech question pool revised already. Just a month after being released to the public, the new technician class question pool has already been revised by the Question Pool Committee of the National Conference of Volunteer Examiner Coordinators. Newsline reports that the post-release review turned up more than 50 typographical errors and the need to further clarify some questions and answers. There are 400 questions in the pool, from which each 35-question Element 2 technician exam will be made up. The new pool will be used in exams beginning July 1, 2010, and will be in use for 4 years. ARRL brings back updated Novice Roundup contest. It's been 15 years since the ARRL stopped running its Novice Roundup contest, which served as an introduction to ham radio and contesting for thousands of new amateurs. Now it is bringing back an updated version dubbed the ARRL Rookie Roundup to encourage hams licensed for 3 years or less to try their hands at on-air competition. The event will be split into three mode-based segments, starting with the single sideband competition this month, followed by RTTY in August and CW in December, according to the ARRL letter. More experienced hams will also be encouraged to operate, but they will be limited to making contest contact with rookie stations. Scoring will be done online in real time using a scoring system at www.getscores.org, which is also where interested hams may go for additional information and to download the required logging program. More information will also be in the April issue of QST Magazine. The last item here, Slow Scan TV for ISS. Crew members on the International Space Station used the station's ham gear in January to transmit slow scan TV, SSTV, images back to hams on Earth. The signals are downlinked on the ISS's standard transmission frequency of 145.800 MHz and may be decoded using widely available free software, according to the AMSAT News Service. The images shot in January showed either crew members inside the station or views out the window of Earth. Many of the photos have been collected and archived on the AMSAT website at www.amsat.org/ARISS/SSTV/. Let's move along now to Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by the editor Rich Mawson, W2VU. Rich titles the April 2010 commentary, The Young and the Digital. Back in January, CQ propagation editor Tomas Hood and W7US started a Facebook page for CQ, as well as separate pages for our other magazines, Popular Communications, CQ VHF, and World Radio Online. This forced me to join Facebook, something I had been resisting for a long time, and that led to some fascinating discoveries. First of all, without any promotion at all, the CQ page quickly gathered about 500 fans. With minimal promotion in the following weeks, a note on our website, that number jumped to about 1,500. Looking at the list of fans and of those hams who started sending me friend requests, I quickly saw a pattern emerging. About half of the fans are outside the United States and Canada, and a disproportionate number compared with our typical readers and our general perception of today's hams are young and or female. Coupled with FCC statistics showing that over 30,000 new hams were licensed last year in the United States and over 100,000 in the past 4 years, it is becoming obvious that there is a growing number of newer hams out there, many of them young, who are not being reached in traditional ways. Like other young people today, they're not big on joining clubs or doing much of anything analog. We are not reaching to the majority of them in a traditional way, but the response we are getting from our Facebook page is a very loud message that they are out there, they know who we are, and they want to engage, but on their terms, on their turf. Today's young people hang out on social networking sites. That's where they keep in touch with their friends, meet new people, and exchange information about hobbies. It's up to us to go where they are, and our Facebook page is the first step. Getting our writers and readers on there and involved in the next step, and it's already beginning. Propagation editor NWSUS, who took the initiative to set up the page, is actively greeting those who post messages and is himself posting regular, near real-time propagation updates, something that simply is not possible in a monthly magazine. Last night, I posted photos from the chilly Orlando Hamcation Hamfest just before the March issue came out. Get building editor Joe Eisenberg, K0NEB, posted a note alerting fans to what his column was about and encouraging them to watch for it. CQWPX contest director Randy Thompson, K5ZD, has started a WPX contest page on Facebook. Elsewhere on the Internet, Public Service Editor Richard Fisher, KI6SN, has a blog site serving as a supplement to his printed column. Several of our columnists have their own websites. As time goes on, I'm sure that more of our editors and authors will make their way onto our Facebook page or other sites and engage readers and potential readers in conversations that build on their columns in the magazine. This is a natural progression for us. If you look back at CQ's original mission statement in the January 1945 issue, before anybody had ever heard of our mission statement, one of our goals was for the magazine to be an online conversation with the readers about ham radio, but not on ham radio. Rather, in the printed pages of each issue of CQ. Today, such conversations extend beyond the printed page and onto the Internet. We encourage you to join us on Facebook if you're a member, to meet your fellow hams, who may be a lot younger than you are, discuss things, make sketch, etc. Now, regarding the American resurgence, I'm writing this a couple of days after returning home from the coldest Orlando hamcation I can remember in more than a decade of regular attendance. Early morning temperatures were in the upper 30s, and I needed to wear gloves while wandering the flea market. I even needed to keep my jacket on inside for the first hour or so on Saturday morning. Chilly weather aside, it was an excellent show as always, and it was great to meet and greet so many of our readers. At one point during the show, one of our neighbors in the exhibit hall pointed out that all of the companies in our row were selling products made in America. This included transceiver manufacturers 10 Tech and L-Craft, as well as Buddy Pole and GAP antennas, Times Microwave, and us. Beyond our aisles were Vibraplex, DXKid, MFJ, Armitron, High Gain Cushman, W2IHY Audio Products, Heel Sound, Hex Beam, and others that I'm sure I'm missing. But the point is that while the transceiver market continues to be dominated by our friends from Japan, the ham radio industry in the United States is alive and well and growing, just as ham radio itself in the United States is alive and well and growing. Now, let's talk about column realignments. This issue contains the final World of Ideas and QRP columns written by Dave Ingram, called K4TWJ, before he became a silent key in January. Dave's passing has resulted in some realignments of our columns, a process that had actually begun before he became ill, and that is not yet complete. Last month, we introduced a new column called Ham Notebook by our longtime beginners editor, Wayne Yoshida, KH6WZ. This column allows Wayne to continue exploring his many interests without being tied to keeping things on a newcomer's level. While we didn't plan it this way, Ham Notebook will become somewhat of a spiritual success to K4TWJ's signature World of Ideas column, in that it will be wide-ranging and go where Wayne's interests take it, much as World of Ideas was guided by Dave's wide-ranging interests. As part of this initial transition, we asked Rich Arland, A-R-L-A-N-D, called K7SZ, to continue Beginner's Corner on an every-other-month basis, alternating with Ham Notebook. Dave's passing changed that plan somewhat. In this issue, we introduce Learning Curve by K7SZ, which will appear monthly and will merge elements of both Beginner's Corner and K4TWJ's How It Works column. While the column will retain its beginner's focus, it will also offer information that far too many of us old-timers have either forgotten or forgot to learn in the first place. Rick starts out this month with a look at basic considerations for setting up a ham shack, a topic of value to beginners and veteran hams alike. Editorship of our QRP column, that's Dave's final installment on page 85, will be assumed as of the June issue by well-known low-power operator Cam Hartford, call N6GA. We welcome Cam to our staff. Still to be worked out are the specifics as how we will continue to provide regular coverage of topics that Dave regularly covered in World of Ideas, including code keys, crystal sets, and projects involving tube rigs. For now, we will be looking for feature articles on those subjects. Finally, we got some great articles this month, including an interview with the Grammy winner and CW aficionado Larnell Stu Harris, called WD4LZZ, Professor Heisloff's annual visit to our pages, and a thought-provoking article on Dictators and Amateur Radio by a ham who grew up behind the Iron Curtain and is now free to write about it. Well, that's Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by Rich Mawson, signed 73 Rich, W2VU. Well, before I go too much further, I'm going to give you some announcements of what's happening with ham radio events. We're already on the very first day of April as I'm recording this, so if I happen to mention a date that's already gone by in April, I apologize. Let's start with special event stations that are scheduled for the month of April. K4S, Kilo 4 Sierra, from Venice Shark's Tooth Festival, Venice, Florida, Tamiami Amateur Radio Club. That's 1300 through 1900 Zulu, April 11, on all the various frequencies. You can QSL and get wallpaper from that. Special call N4C, November 4, Charlie, from the 38th Annual Raleigh, North Carolina Hemp Fest, an ARRL State Convention, Raleigh Amateur Radio Club. That's on April 3rd on single sideband. You'll probably miss that one. Now, here's some of the following hamfests that are slated for April and early May. The Missouri CUSO Party, this annual event sponsored by the Boeing Employees Amateur Radio Society in St. Louis, will be held at 1800 Zulu April 3 through 0500 Zulu April 4. The object is to make as many CUSOs with as many Missouri amateur radio stations and to contact as many different Missouri counties as possible. Now for Hamfest, April 10th, Orange County ARC Spring Hamfest, town of Wallkill Community Center, Middletown, New York. Also on April 10 and 11, the 12th Annual Communications Academy, South Seattle Community College, Seattle, Washington. They're offering 30 workshops and seminars related to amateur radio. They're going to be vendors, displays, etc. Now, April 16 through 18, the 61st Annual International DX Convention. It's at the Holiday Inn Hotel and Conference Center, Visalia, California. April 17, Ham Expo, Bell County Expo Center, Belton, Texas. May 1st, Blue Ridge Amateur Radio Society Hamfest and ARRL South Carolina Section Convention, Piedmont Interstate Fairgrounds in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Also May 1st, Valley of the Moon ARC, that call is W6AFJ, the ARRL Hamfest, Sonoma Valley Veterans Memorial Building, Sonoma, California. One more, May the 1st, the 48th Annual Cadillac Swap, Cadillac Junior High School, Cadillac, Michigan. You know, folks, in our introduction a few moments ago, CQ mentioned the fact that Grammy-winning singer-songwriter Larnell, known as Stu Harris, WD4LCC, was featured with an article here in the April 2010 CQ magazine. I must tell you that I'm very impressed by the beautiful presentation of the material in the article. A lot of really great color pictures and a great story about Stu Harris, called WD4LZC, a fellow ham. It's authored by David Greer, called N4KZ. I'll read just the introduction. In 1978, WD4LZC was a newly licensed novice class amateur radio operator in Louisville, Kentucky. And like all new operators, he was a bit nervous about making his first on-the-air CW contact. CW, no, is Morse code. When that first QSO began, he sent his name, L-A-R-N-E-L-L-E, three times at a slow but steady 5 words per minute. "You know what?" Larnell asked. The other operator, an experienced ham, told me, "We'll have to work on that name. It takes too long to send." Since Larnell's middle name is Stuart, he changed his on-the-air name to Stu, S-T-U, a shortened version of Stuart. It's an on-the-air nickname that stuck, and he still uses it more than 30 years later. "I think Stu is much friendlier than Larnell," Harris said. "Now, with the internet, people look me up and tell me, 'I see your name is Larnell.' I tell them, 'Don't worry about it.' Although many hams know WD4LZC as Stu, millions more worldwide know him as Larnell Harris, accomplished singer, recording artist, and writer of more than 30 inspirational songs. Actor CW operators know Stu loves Morse code as well. There's a certain irony in the fact that a man who has a tremendous tenor singing voice and has achieved huge success on the strength of his voice seldom uses his voice on the ham bands. After all, Harris has recorded 19 albums, won 5 Grammy Awards, and more than a dozen Dove Awards, the most prestigious award in Christian and gospel music. Has earned numerous other awards, including 2 honorary doctorates, performed at the White House and the Kremlin, and sung during several Billy Graham crusades. However, he has no microphone connected to the Icon IC-756 Pro 3 that sits on his ham shack desk, tucked into the corner of his home's family room. "When I first get the radio," Harris said, "I connect the microphone and make sure everything works. I leave it connected for a couple of weeks, and then I put it away. If you look at my log, you will only find a handful of phone contacts." This ham loves CW. He even thinks about it when he's not on the air from his home station. As a voice major in college at Western Kentucky University, I did a lot of French, German, and Elizabethan love songs, and some in Italian. Therefore, CW is just like another language to me. Harris admits to being a multitasker by nature, but notes, CW is the only thing I have found where I cannot do anything else other than listen to the other person on the other end of that key and try to get to know him and try to share the experience of the day. When I first started in ham radio, he continued, I worked a lot of CW. But I was fascinated by the microphone, and I enjoyed that. But now I am trying to take Go to another level. I am copying 25 to 30 words per minute in my head, and that is really exciting to me. When people see me walking down the street, I'm listening to something, and they think, since I'm a musician, that I'm listening to my latest CD. No, I'm listening to code tapes and W1AW at 35 words per minute and trying to figure it out. Among Harris's most recent accolades are being introduced into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame in 2007 and, in 2008, into the CQ Amateur Radio Hall of Fame, based on his many professional achievements. In 1993, he was given the Silver Bell Award from the Ad Council for his song, Mighty Spirit, which was the theme song for the longest-running public service announcement in TV history, done for the Points of Light Foundation. Harris has an infectious enthusiasm for many aspects of his life, his family, his love of God and his strong faith, his music, an interest in other people, golf, and, of course, ham radio. Mitzi, Larnell's wife of 38 years, is also a ham. She is K-A-4-T-E-W, Kilo Alpha 4 Tango Echo Whiskey. Mitzi is a teacher and has a master's degree in special education. I just knew two married people would have fun on 2 meters, Darnell said. I know this was God's plan for us, he said, with a loud laugh. Now, as I said a few minutes ago, folks, it's a really long article, beautifully done, a lot of beautiful photographs. But if you want to know more about WD4LZC and his music, Larnell Harris is known mostly as a solo performer, but also spent years performing with the groups The Spurlows and the Gaither Vocal Band. He also has recorded several duets with noted gospel singer Sandy Patty. Several can be viewed on YouTube. If you'd like to learn more about Larnell Harris and his music, here are a few online resources. Point. Go to Google and type in Larnell Harris. Again, that's spelled LARNELLEHARRIS. You will get 48,600 hits. Point, go to YouTube at www.youtube.com and you will find 150 videos of Larnell Harris performing. Or you can go to www.larnell.com. to learn more about his music, many awards and accomplishments, and more. Larnell is offering a special discount to CQ readers who order through his website. On checkout, enter the code CQLARNELLE in uppercase in the promotions box, and the discount will be applied. We have another featured article here by Joe Moell, spelled M-O-E-L-L, Joe Moell. It's called K-0-O-V, Kilo Zero, Oscar Victor. Get ready for fox hunting season. The arrival of spring means that it's time to prepare for direction-finding fun on the streets and in the woods. On New Year's Day, did you resolve to try something new in ham radio during 2010? Did you promise yourself that you would improve your physical fitness? Have you been looking for ways to get the whole family involved in ham radio activities? I have 3 words for you. Hidden transmitter hunting. It's a technical challenge, a fitness builder, a source of intrigue and adventure, plus great ham camaraderie all rolled into one activity. Amateur radio operators have been tracking down signals since the 1930s, starting at ham fests with one-tube transmitters and hand-carried crystal sets. Later, it became known as fox hunting, and that name has persisted ever since. There is a pursuit aspect to it, of course, but that's the only similarity to the centuries-old horse and hounds sport that is now banned in England. Gear for RDF, radio direction finding, can be much more complicated nowadays, but it doesn't have to be. The vast majority of transmitter hunts take place on the 2-meter band with the participants using their handy talkies and homemade beam antennas. It's simple, inexpensive, and an excellent way to learn soldering and home construction skills. The folks at CQ Magazine know a great ham radio activity when they see one, which led me to begin promoting an annual weekend of fox hunting activity back in 1998. This year's CQ Worldwide Fox Hunting Weekend will be May 22-23. As Fox Hunting Weekend moderator, I have the pleasure of getting reports and photos from hams who have discovered a new way to enjoy their hobby. What's more, the skills they learn are very important when it's time to find sources of interference, either accidental or intentional. Some of them are now helping Civil Air Patrol and search and rescue agencies using RDF, radio direction finding, equipment to track downed aircraft and persons in distress. After more than a half century, mobile transmitter hunting, sometimes called T-hunting, is still the most popular form of RDF contesting in the United States. Every weekend, hams gather in vehicles bristling with antennas, including some rotating Yagis and quads. One or more other hams have an adventure planned for them. To win a mobile T-hunt, a vehicular team must get to all those radio foxes first, or do it with least mileage added to the odometer. The winning criteria depends on the local hunt rules, and so does the reward. The best team usually wins the job of transmitting next time. That can be just as much fun. Will they find a perfect hiding location to keep the mobile hunters driving for hours? A growing number of hams prefer transmitter hunts that are all on foot. What a great way to involve kids and grandkids, because no driver's license is needed, or a ham license for that matter, since only the hider is transmitting. A cookout and fox hunt at a local park makes a great ham club activity on Fox Hunting Weekend or any other. Tiny 2-meter transmitters can be cleverly concealed under rocks or up in trees. You might even find one inside a fake boulder or tree limb. In another kind of on-foot fox hunting, everyone follows an internationally agreed-upon set of rules, requiring the transmitters to be set up in a special orienteering course with orange and white flags, unique registration punches, or electronic scoring. With practice and perseverance, you can win medals and other honors in ARDF, no matter what your age. National championships take place annually in about 24 countries around the world. USA's will be on Fox Hunting Weekend this year, organized by members of Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana Amateur Radio Club, and the Butler County VHF Society. Now, folks, let's take a look at the radio fox hunting with international rules. Around the United States and the world, there are wide differences in the guidelines and rules for transmitter hunts and vehicles. Each group develops the kind of mobile contests that suit the skill and temperament of the local tea hunters, as well as the geography and climate of the region. Roll your own rules won't work when radio orienteers gather from all parts of the country and the globe to test their skills on foot in the forest. As interest in ARDF spread through Europe 3 decades ago, a committee of the International Amateur Radio Union, that's the familiar IARU, was formed to standardize the rules. That made it possible to hold the first World ARDF Championships in 1980. As the sport has grown in popularity, the rules have kept up. Their purpose is to ensure that winners have the ideal combination of direction-finding skill, orienteering ability, and physical stamina. After its start on 80 meters with just three age gender categories, championship ARDF now has six age categories for men and five for women. Now 60-year-olds don't have to compete against 20 or 40-year-olds. Having more categories also means that more gold, silver, and bronze medals are available to be won. Nowadays, the ARDF World Championships take place every even-numbered year in a country that is selected by the ARDF Working Group of IARU. Each participating country may send three competitors in each of the age-gender categories. The next World Championships will be on the coast of Croatia in September. After this year's national championships on Fox Hunting Weekend, invitations for membership in ARDF Team USA will be given to the best performers in each category in those championships near Cincinnati and in the 2009 USA Championships near Boston. Now for the listener, if you want to read the whole article, it's titled Get Ready for Fox Hunting Season by Joe Moell, spelled M-O-E-L-L, call K0OV. It begins on page 18 and concludes on page 21 of CQ Magazine for April 2010. You'll enjoy it. Try it. I think I mentioned springtime a few minutes ago. Other things that are very popular in springtime and right through the year are ham fests that are on the outside with a theme for the outdoors. We have a nice article here about the Deerfield, New Hampshire Fair. The Deerfield Fair is a New Hampshire tradition extending back 130 years. Good communications are essential, and the near Fest, Ham Fest organization, cemented its relationship with the Fairground Board of Directors, that's NEAR-Fest. It's held at the Deerfield Fairgrounds by becoming the communications vendor and coordinator for the fair. One strategy for making sure your Ham Fest site remains available, says the chairman of NEAR-Fest, is to make your group a resource for your hosts as well as a client. The piece here is titled, How to Keep Your Ham Fest's Venue, or Making Friends with Your Radio. Our contributing author, Michael Krestol, spelled C-R-E-S-T-O-H-L, Michael Krestol, call W1-R-C, Whiskey 1, Romeo Charlie. We in New England have been very fortunate to have enjoyed a wonderful semi-annual regional ham fest known as Horse Trader, H-O-S-S, Traders, Horse Traders, which was held at five venues in New Hampshire during its 34-year run. These events were overnighters at several fairgrounds, and without question, the most beloved of these sites was the Deerfield, New Hampshire Fairgrounds, where the Hamfest was held from 1976 to 1992. Since May 2007, this wonderful venue has been the home of the New England Amateur Radio Festival, a.k.a. NEAR Fest. As NEAR Fest General Chairman and Benevolent Dictator, my principal job is to foster and maintain positive relations with the Fair Association's Board of Directors. These are the folks who decide who can rent the grounds and how much they will have to pay for the privilege. Since board members are elected annually, directors are always changing. Thus, maintaining cordial relations with them represents an ongoing challenge. I have witnessed several other great hamfests either disappear completely, such as Far Fest at Montgomery County Fairgrounds, Gaithersburg, Maryland, or be seriously impacted, as in Shelby, North Carolina, as a result of a decision by their respective fairgrounds board of directors that wasn't in the best interest of amateur radio community. This was my biggest concern in running this Hamfest, because we did not want to lose this wonderful venue. No other fairgrounds I have ever seen comes close to Deerfield as such a perfect spot for a Hamfest, and quite frankly, I can't see myself doing it anywhere else. From the very beginning, we adopted a highly proactive stance regarding keeping the grounds immaculate and making sure that everyone removed everything they didn't sell. We virtually banned CRT monitors from the free market. That's the old television-looking monitors. Most people understood our concerns, but a few miscreants who didn't get it had it explained to them in language that even they could understand by our sergeant-at-arms, Paul DePetrillo, W1PRA. In addition, we added two fire wardens to our roster, a couple of former firefighters, to enforce the Fair Association's no-smoking policy and our outdoor cooking rules. However, because of problems with other groups in the past, our relationship was tenuous at best, even with these efforts. In the summer of 2008, an opportunity presented itself when the fair director, who was my point of contact, called and asked if I would like to serve as superintendent of radios for the fair itself, as the person who had been doing it no longer wanted the job. This was a big deal. The Deerfield Fair is the oldest agricultural fair in New England, having been held annually for over 130 years. It's a real old-fashioned, down-home kind of family fair that allows no alcohol or gambling, and the traditional gang of carnies simply are not permitted to participate. Notwithstanding, I live 90 miles from the fairgrounds and would have had to commute for 5 days, so I recommended someone who lives considerably closer as a very suitable candidate, particularly since he has experience in the two-way business. This is how it came to pass that Ed Anderson, call N1IWV, near Fest's treasurer, became superintendent of radios at the 2008 Deerfield Fair. Ed's experiences would make an article in itself, but suffice it to say that there were several issues with the rented radios. The vendor was arrogant and rude. He made it abundantly clear that he didn't care for amateur radio operators very much. There were only two channels in use, the equipment was old and tired, and so were the batteries. Clearly, the system needed a major upgrade, and I could see another opportunity to show the board members that the radio amateurs who rented their fairgrounds twice a year could be a valuable resource to them in the future, and the future was now. Ed and I met with the board of directors in late October. Our first order of business to discuss was expanding the number of UHF frequencies for which they were licensed. We felt that having more channels available would be a major factor in improving their communications capabilities during the fair. The board agreed and asked if I could help them do this. A motion immediately was passed empowering NearFest to act as their official agent in dealing with the FCC. With the help of a frequency coordination company, I was able to add 10 frequencies, which were granted by the FCC in early January. So they now had 12 channels available to them instead of two. I also modified their ULS file and named NearFest Inc. as their dealer. I then proposed to my FairFest colleagues that we offer to rent radios to the fair at a significant savings over what they had been previously paying. We could buy surplus commercial equipment at reasonable costs, at the HamFest, of course, and program the radios with their frequencies. I quoted a rental price that was about half the going rate, which the board eagerly accepted. Now, looking to the future, a week after NearFest 6, I received a phone call from Cheryl asking me if NearFest would be interested in again providing the radios for 2010. Apparently, the board was very satisfied with the radio services we provided and passed a motion to invite us back. With this as a consideration, I declared the project a success and now look forward to enjoying a good relationship with these folks for many years to come. Many amateur radio clubs are facing a similar dilemma when it comes to their ham fest or flea market, even those in school cafeterias and gymnasiums. It seems that every season some well-established fleas and fests are disappearing from the calendar because the club or group loses its venue. A little creative thinking will go a long way here, and provided you use commercial frequencies if they are available, you can strengthen a relationship or build a new one while adding a substantial amount to your club's treasury in the process. Well, I have another interesting article by the editor of CQ Magazine here, Rich Mawson, called W2VU. The piece is titled, Ham's Gone Wild, Amateur Radio, and National Wildlife Refuge Week. The tent full of radio gear was sitting on a slab of concrete underneath the gazebo outside the brand new visitor center at New Jersey's Great Swamp National Wildlife Refuge. We were thankful for the concrete that cold and rainy day in mid-October, since most of what surrounded us was mud. But it was also kind of ironic. Had it not been for the efforts of the woman whose former home was now the refuge's visitor center, most of the 7,600-acre natural preserve which surrounded us would have been concrete. What is today the Great Swamp National Wildlife Refuge, home to more than 200 species of birds, small mammals, and aquatic life, and an important stop on the Atlantic Flyway for migratory birds, was once slated to become a major jet port. Helen C. Fenske, a local resident, spearheaded a grassroots effort to block the plans and protect the magnificent natural area just a stone's throw from New York City. Had she not succeeded, the gazebo in which I was sitting might have been a runway. Each of the nation's more than 500 national wildlife refuges has its own story, some more dramatic than others, and together they form a network across all 50 states and beyond of protected areas set aside to conserve fish, wildlife, and plants. Administered by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, part of the Department of the Interior, they range from pockets of preserved natural areas near major cities to entire islands, such as Desejo, prefix KP5, and Navassa, KP1, in the Caribbean. Yet they do not have anywhere near the visibility or recognition of our national parks. In an effort to raise public awareness of these natural gems, in 1995, the Fish and Wildlife Service began to designate the second week in October each year as National Wildlife Refuge Week. Amateur radio has been part of that effort since 2006, although last year's marked the first coordinated nationwide effort. The first AM to run a special event station in concert with National Wildlife Refuge Week was John Forslin, KC8ULE, of Marquette, Michigan, operating in 2006 from Sinai, NWR, in Michigan's Upper Peninsula. He tried to get some interest from other hams by contacting managers at other refuges and had some success, notably attracting the attention of Mike Thomas, NA5U, who was an integral part of the group attempting to get the FWS to approve ham radio operations from Navassa and Desejo. One of the project's goals, says Mike, was to develop a long-term relationship between ham radio and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Toward that end, he had already formed the W5 National Wildlife Refuge Amateur Radio Club, secured the vanity call W5NWR for its operations, and put a station on the air at the Shohemingo NWR in Oklahoma. After the success of K5D expedition to Desejo in early 2009, the KP1 through 5 project became the national coordinator of NWR Week amateur radio operations, and three of its volunteers were named to an advisory committee to organize the activity and coordinate with the Fish and Wildlife Service in establishing guidelines for refuge operations. From the beginning, an important part of this activity has been that any group wanting to operate from a national wildlife refuge must, with emphasis, have written permission from the refuge manager and must coordinate all activities with refuge officials. When the operation became national in scope last year, it also became mandatory for any group operating from a refuge to register with the amateur radio coordinators as well. In 2009, NWR Week ran from October 11 through 17, and hams operated from 14 national wildlife refuges and one wildlife management area in 10 states, plus the K4MD expedition from Midway Atoll, NWR, in the Pacific Island. Several groups had one-by-one special event call signs for the occasion, such as W2R, Whiskey 2 Romeo, the station from which I operated at the Great Swamp, NWR in New Jersey. W2R was run by the New Providence Amateur Radio Club over a three-day period from Friday, October 16, to Sunday, October 18. I spent a few hours there on Saturday afternoon in weather that felt more like mid-November than mid-October. In fact, it was warmer here in mid-December this year than it was that weekend in October. It was rainy and windy with near-freezing temperatures, but sitting in front of the radio warmed you up inside, if not outside. A tour of the new visitor center was helpful for outer-body warming. I don't remember how many contacts I personally made, but numbers were not really the goal here. It wasn't a contest, and each QSO went on for several minutes at minimum, as we explained where we were and what the special event was about. Overall, the activity was a great way to help promote our National Wildlife Refuges to hams, to promote ham radio at the wildlife refuges, and, of course, to enjoy all the great wildlife viewing opportunities afforded by visiting a National Wildlife Refuge. And, oh yes, it was a lot of fun. For information on taking part in National Wildlife Refuge Week in 2010, you can go to this website, www.nwrweek-radio.info website, or you can contact Mike Thomas, call NA5U. You can look him up at the QRZ, ham call address, website. Well, I'll change the topic now, going to Magic in the Sky by Jeff Reinhardt, AA6JR. April Fool or not, as a group of those who share a technical pastime or passion, our culture of inventiveness both precedes us and abounds. It is also fed, or perhaps feeds upon itself, from that very first eureka moment, usually embedded in that rare occasion when one of our creations or repairs actually works, even if only for a nanosecond or two. The rare genius of good Professor Hyslop, notwithstanding, many of us have been inspired by the vision, inventiveness, or reckless abandon for personal safety of others. Ben Franklin flying a kite in a thunderstorm comes to mind, and perhaps Madame Curie experimenting with radium. Both knew they were putting themselves at risk. Perhaps at the time they did not know exactly how much risk their actions invited. My personal experiments in radio have been blessedly absent of true adventure, such as being thrown across the room by rude and ill-mannered voltage. Much of my early experimentation was with passive circuits such as crystal radios, later daringly upgraded to diode models. Okay, you can say wimp, but after a few experiments that familiarized me with the tingles of 110 AC volts from occasionally misplaced fingers, it was an experience I quickly associated with words such as unpleasant. In the seventh grade, our science teacher gave a class lesson on the electrolysis of water using a DC voltage, two inverted test tubes, each with one of the DC wires at its base, and a dash of vinegar in the water to act as a catalyst. Voila! After a day, we had the classic two test tubes filled with the base components of water, one with hydrogen, the other with oxygen. The instructor lit a match while lifting and tipping the hydrogen-filled test tube, and the gas burned with a pop. He then blew out the match and inserted it into the oxygen test tube, and the pure oxygen caused it to briefly burst back into flame. From the vantage point of a seventh-grade science geek, how cool is that? I explained to him that my electronic technician dad had a big DC power supply in his basement workshop, and I would repeat the experiment at home using bigger containers, maybe even jars, to collect the hydrogen and oxygen. I asked if I should write a paper, for extra credit, of course, with my findings. The science teacher wisely responded, "No need to write a report. I'll read about it in the newspaper." Undaunted, I survived my at-home experiments, and in the eighth grade I took on the challenge of inventing perpetual motion, simply because I read it had not yet been done. Forget flywheels and balance mechanisms. That's old school. On paper, I designed a project with an elevated reservoir, a hydroelectric power plant at the bottom, and a siphon to take the water back up to the reservoir. Okay, so in the scale mock-up stage, I learned siphons can only work downhill, overcoming just a little lift with the help of atmospheric pressure. Not one to give up a good idea easily. Instead, my Mark II generator powers an electric pump. Eighth grade students are blissfully ignorant of resistance, friction, efficiency, pumping losses, and the like. Hey, it made sense at the time. When you can be 13 years old and know everything about everything, right? Fast forwarding through time, tapping into her father's faulty genetics, the third grade science project inspired my daughter to build the, quoting, Back to the Future anti-gravity skateboard. We actually came up with a design that got her a good grade. It was a foam hoverboard, genuinely floating in a confined environment of opposing magnets. I think a rotwork was a key element that helped to carry the day with her teacher. So, what's on your invention wish list besides world peace and a 200-mile-per-gallon high-performance automobile engine? It would be nice to see small broadband HF antennas that send and receive well, a mobile AM, FM, HF, VHF, UHF, GPS radio that actually fits in the space now occupied by standard radio receivers in cars, a means of HF propagation that defeats the absence of sunspots, and the placement of a solar-powered repeater on the moon, making EME a bit more attainable for those of us who are antenna-challenged. I also want to see a working version of the Star Trek transponder. When it comes to successes, we're often taught to think of the successful efforts by the likes of Gutenberg, who laid the groundwork for making this magazine possible, Morse, Bell, Marconi, Edison, DeForest, Armstrong, Bardee, Shockley, and Brayton, and so many others. The faulty impression would be that they only knew success. The truth is that many failed. Efforts and experiments preceded their respective accomplishments. So maybe Tesla was a bit offbeat. It's hard to think of an inventor who didn't have a design or idea that didn't work. One of the lamentable upshots of today's manufactured and dependable electronics, including ham radio, is the disappearance of the home workshop, complete with junk boxes of salvaged or surplus parts. Fun stock clips and other items that made breadboard designs possible, either for a specific project or a winter's night of puttering around for experimenting. Thus, while we may chuckle at an item or effort that's fitting for the April edition of CQ, many an unconventional idea has made bank for its visionary parent. So what's up your sleeve? Cold fusion? Magnetic propulsion? Power generated by ocean waves? A new communications mode? How about 3D home TV that doesn't require goofy glasses? Dare to think big and outside all the boxes after all. The impossible accomplishment of sending communications over long distances in real time was once the domain of gods known to some as Mercury or Hermes. Today, it's folks like you and me who have at our command the magic in the sky. Well, folks, this brings us to a conclusion of the digest format of CQ Magazine for April 2010 here on the Courage and Ham System. I apologize for some background hum. It's a Saturday morning, quite early, but there are people out there trying to cut their grass or do something wild in their so-called spare time. So I'll have to say 73s and thanks a lot for listening. CQ is a production of the CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512. Or at email address, handyham@courage.org. Wonderful website, kept up to date all the time, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. My QTH, or general location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Thanks a lot for listening along with me again this month to the digest format reading of CQ Magazine, April 2010. Bye-bye.